Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome John Michael McDonagh and Brendan Gleeson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you in one piece here.
Yeah. The resurrection.
And I do want to acknowledge that we have two of the producers, the co-producers of the film, Lizzie Eaves and Flora Fernandez, are here with us. So, amazing work. I just want to congratulate both of you. It's such a powerful, extraordinary film. And I just wanted to, I guess, start by asking you, I guess you started to work on the script around the time that you were working on The Guard together? Could you talk about
when that started? I didn't go to film school, and basically post-production on The Guard was my version of film school. I mean, it was there are lots of different edits of that movie, let's put it that way. It went on for a long time. And it went on so long that, you know, an idea Brendan and I had spoken about when we were in the last week of shooting in Connemara and on The Guard, I actually wrote the script because it had gone on so long, the post-production, which it's good, though, because you got your next movie set up quite quickly. I was glad that the editing on Calvary went a lot smoother. I think the prolonged editing on The Guard actually made me a better writer in a way. I think I refined a lot of the things I was doing, and I was a lot more precise second time around, let's put it that way.
Could you talk a bit about where this impulse came from? I mean, the idea of having, you know, as one of the characters says in the films, it would be interesting to have a good priest as a character. You know, we've been used to seeing a number of films with bad priests.
Yeah, I think the first impulse was to make a film about a good person. And then I just thought there'd be more movies coming out, you know, dealing with all the scandals, and there'd be a lot of those films that were about bad priests, and the intention was to do the exact opposite. So that's where it all came from. You know, there's not that many movies made about genuinely good people. They're usually conflicted in some way, or, you know, a lot of movies, the villain drives the story, you know. I mean, you could say in this, you know, the good man reacts to what all those eccentric supporting characters are doing to him. So you could say they drive the narrative and he responds to it, I suppose.
And could you talk about how you work together? I mean, my understanding was that you read the script very early on and were actually involved in developing it somewhat. So could you, which is, I think, unusual for an actor and director to work like that together.
Yeah, well, we'd kind of chatted about the notion of this. We had a common interest in it, and we loved working together on The Guard. It was, you know, it was a good collaboration, and so we were anxious to kind of do something together again. So it was great. John, you know, sent me the first draft, which is, you know, fantastic to get, and it was very moving, and I knew it was there, that, you know, that it was exquisite already, and there were a few things that I had that I felt maybe I knew this guy possibly particularly through you know, Kelly Riley's through the daughter, that I felt I knew him most through that, and she disappeared a little bit early
in the original draft. When she leaves, we don't see her again.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was that. So there was. I just gave whatever tuppence halfpenny worth I had, and then. So that's it. Kind of. So he took it from there and did what was needed. And so by the time the script came in its completion, I kind of knew who I was dealing with in a sense, you know.
We developed. It became more emotional. I mean, the scenes was there, and the basis of the characters were there. But I think the scene with Kelly in the confessional that was added. I think the big scene where they have their reconciliation on the cliff face was there, but I think it was expanded upon. She's there at the end, that the phone call was put in as well, which obviously you see the film now, you think how could that never have been there, but it wasn't in the first draft. It's just I realized, shouldn't he say goodbye to somebody, when Brendan was saying there should be more scenes with Kelly, or I kind of miss her when she's gone. Yeah. I thought, yeah, okay, he'll ring her as a way of bringing her back.
I this is sort of a big question, but I just want to hear more about the impulse to make this film. And we've seen films that deal with very specific crimes committed by the Catholic Church, and this is like larger than that. This is really taking a large view, and it's a film that I think applies to not just the Catholic Church. If you look at what's going on in the world, it seems to be getting more relevant by the day.
So, yeah, I mean, for me, I'm not a big fan of movies where the director has a political point he wants to make and he creates the film based on that political point. I think that leads to bad art, to be honest. I always start with the characters first and then try to think of an interesting plot. Whatever comes out of that, whatever the subtext are, if you've got a good story, there's always going to be lots of sort of symbolic or metaphorical elements to it. And obviously the actors are going to find, you know, those kinds of scenes that have different subtext to them. But the starting point should always be create good characters and create a good plot, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the only hope I had when it came out, because I kind of knew once I saw it in its final, you know, incarnation, that I knew it was a good film. It's never proven until an audience is there. But the one thing I hoped was that it would have a universality that was beyond Catholicism, beyond Irishness and the Irish situation at the present time. Like, to me, it's about, I know when I was doing it, I felt very compromised about this idea of, you know, the reason for optimism and the duty, in a way, to maintain optimism in the face of all available evidence, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like that to believe in humankind of itself is what's at issue, and that, you know, whilst the people that are there have very extreme viewpoints about very specific things, the common problem is that nobody trusts anything in authority, so that the moral leadership has been corrupted and has failed people, and people feel betrayed by it. So it felt to me that was... what was at issue. It was far more central to anything that's, you know, specific.
Yeah, and could you talk at all about the tone or the style of the film? I mean, it has... First of all, it feels very literary. I mean, you almost think it was adapted from something, but
yeah,
it wasn't.
someone suggested they thought it could be a play, and I thought it should be grand opera rather than a play.
Yeah.
I think of myself as a failed novelist. I wrote four or five bad novels that never were published. So I think I think in my screenwriting there's a novelistic quality to it, rather than a theatrical quality. I think, you know, all those supporting characters are very rich. I think, you know, you could kind of follow Aidan Gillen's atheistic doctor into his own movie, you know, or you could make a movie about how Chris O'Dowd's character got to the place he was in, you know. So I think it's dense in that way. Tonally, I don't think about tone when I'm writing, because that sort of smacks to me of censorship, if you're thinking that way. It's only when I get to the editing where, again, I don't really think of, is this scene gone too far? Is it too aggressive a confrontation? I think in terms of, you know, have we had too many really dark scenes in a row, you know? So maybe I'll shift them around a bit and have a little bit of light relief, if there is any light relief in the movie. So I only think about tonally in that way, you know. I think when a lot of filmmakers are making movies, especially probably with the studios, and they get notes about tone, I mean, what is tone? You can be having a good time at a party and you get a call saying your grandmother's died. You know, that happens in real life, but we never see that in movies because the executive gives notes saying that's tonally wrong, you know. So I try to put all that to the back of my mind and not go along with it, really.
You had a palette, though. I mean, you had a palette in terms of the Andrew Wyeth thing, which does strike. Like, there was...
Yeah, visually, the images are based on Andrew Wyeth's paintings. So, you know, you have a lot of... the priest world is kind of very black and white. There's lots of frames within frames and all that kind of thing. You have those big swooping helicopter shots. So it goes from really widescreen to real claustrophobia. So that was the visual sort of tone.
And could you talk a bit just about your work? It's an amazing, amazing performance. And so much of it has to do with reaction, you know, with reading what's going on. I mean, there's a lot to work with verbally, but there's so much about reaction.
Well, what I liked about him was that he had both. You know, he was somebody who could listen, but he could listen with empathy. You know, and I thought a lot about it afterwards because I found the actual shoot quite a trial, to be honest with you. I almost went in and punched one of the actors. He was like, you get so fed up with people abusing you day in, day out.
In the role.
In the role.
That particular actor does it in real life as well.
He wasn't talking about. He wasn't talking about you.
Yeah, remorseless, and relentless, and if you were doing it in real life, you have a professional detachment that you have to maintain in order to put up with this sort of stuff. Any professional this man has got like 7 days to live, so he doesn't want a professional detachment, and he commits to it to trying to explore and to absorb other people's pain in that last 7 days. So it was very, an awful lot of it was about absorbing people's suffering, people's pain. But what I liked about the thing and what makes John's writing so exhilarating is that he also had he was a force of nature. He was very, very front foot when he needed to be. And he didn't suffer fools gladly. And anybody that he thought was posturing, he sliced them immediately. Mm. And cut away the nonsense.
Yeah.
So that it wasn't, it was a gift of a role in that way. Of course you had to absorb, but he wasn't just somebody, who lay there and took it all. He kind of bit back a little bit, and that was exciting.
I think, we've spoken about it was sort of partially influenced by Bresson's Diary of a Country Piece, but when we went back and looked at that movie, I mean, the priest in that is a little bit of a wuss, really. He just takes on board everything and doesn't do anything about it. He just sits in his room moaning. I mean, basically.
Yeah, being holy,
Being holy and moaning.
You would have been so much better in that movie. We should remake that.
Yeah, well, there you go. Maybe we did.
You work with your son. Can you tell us who your son is in the film and what that scene was like?
Donald, and my son was the
cannibal serial killer
cannibal. We found ourselves yet again at a table discussing lunch. Sorry, I don't mean to be trite, but yeah. But it was weird. We just didn't talk. We talked a lot about it, and then we sort of went our separate ways about a week before. We had rehearsed and read with John, and then we found we weren't helping each other, really. We both had different perspectives, obviously. And he went into a very particular place that was very different. The hair thing, that's not his hair colour, that kind of odd kind of haircut and things like that, and he went into all that thing. So we kind of separated for a week beforehand and came out basically fighting. And it was a very intense day, I was very glad to get him back, I'll put it that way. But I was very proud of it, the fact that he gave as good as he got,
Yeah. My brother Martin was there on that day. That was the only day he showed up for filming, and he hadn't read the script, and he turned to me and said, "I thought you said this was a comedy." Oh, in my mind, it was always a comedy. I don't know how it's turned out like this.
Your brother, by the way, who directed In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths, so interesting family you have.
Yeah, well, I'll be the more interesting member of the family than my brother.
Could you talk about the structure of the film is great. I mean, the dramatic structure, the way that you set up that you know what's going to happen, and then you're sort of throughout the whole film figuring out it's not a whodunit, but who's going to do it.
Yeah.
So I know there's
that structure. There's also a kind of hidden structure. It's based around the five stages of grief.
Right.
Denial, bargaining, anger, depression, and acceptance. So that there was a loose structure to that. And yeah, you also have I guess they call it the ticking clock, the countdown of the 7 days or whatever. And it has that kind of episodic structure where you're meeting all the suspects, I suppose. So there was, yeah. I wrote it quite quickly because I had all those sort of ideas in mind when I sat down,
And the Hitchcock film, I confess, was that in your
mind? Yeah, that's one of my favorite Hitchcocks. It's not really, doesn't seem to be written about as much as a lot of the others, but I always liked it.
I want to open it up to the audience, but I just wanted to ask you about one thing because I was telling you before we came on that the film that we showed right before this today was The King of Comedy, the Scorsese film, and that was an important film to you. Which I didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, I used to watch a lot of films when I was a kid. That was the first film where I started to get that there is somebody behind the movie who's called the director. And is when I also got that there are some actors are better than other actors. Let's put it that way. That's when it first became clear to me. I think it was because the movie kind of bombed, didn't it, when it first came out. So when it was, I saw it at the cinema, and then it was on like Channel 4 immediately. It seemed to be within a few weeks. I guess because it didn't do well, they just did a quick sale or whatever. Yeah. So I was able to see the movie quite about three times, I think, in the space of 2 months. So yeah, it was a big influence.
Hmm. Okay, go ahead, right over here, and I'll repeat the question. So,
what was the reason why the daughter saw the killer in jail?
Why did the daughter see the killer in jail?
Well, you know, people can come up with their own reasoning. The reasoning for me is that she's taken on board her father's discussions about forgiveness. And to me, he doesn't die because his ideals have lived on in her, basically. You know, does she forgive him or not? It's a part of the beginning of a process, probably. I wouldn't say she already forgives him, but she's willing to communicate with him.
So yeah, I have to say, for me, that was a huge thing. When I saw the film, I found it very affecting because, you know, you felt that compassion was still alive. And the whole film is a quest, in a way, for me it was, anyway. You know, to maintain that faith in compassion. And that at the end, I think too, is an interesting thing about whether in the edit, at one point there was a thing about on the other side.
In an early draft, he doesn't pick up the phone.
Yeah.
And as we came to shoot it, I decided that was taking nihilism a bit too far. I thought I'd give the audience a modicum of hope at the end.
Okay, right over here.
Can you guys talk about the town that you shot it in, and also casting and working with M.M. Walsh?
Okay, yeah, the town. Well, can you talk about the town where you filmed it in, which, aside from you, it's not usually used for film, and then the casting, M.M. Walsh. It was great to see him on screen.
Yeah, on both The Guard and Calvary, I'm trying to get away from Dublin, basically. So I'm trying to.
I'm from Dublin.
I'm trying to get away from Dublin and Dublin people.
up the Dobbs.
I welcome confrontation, so you can boo as much as you like. So I was, you know, The Guard was, I was trying to show Galway, and this one I was trying to show Sligo. You know, the reference in the movie to surfing, and we have cutaways of surfers, that's all genuine. It is a big surfing destination, strangely enough. It's where my mother was from, Eastkey, and we used to go there for summer holidays, so I knew all the locations. I kind of like to have that in my mind, to set scenes in specific places, you know, so that was always going on. I knew it was, you know, it was just a landscape we hadn't really seen before. M.M. Walsh was just, you know, this is one of those things, you know, a character actor I'd always loved for years and years and years, and my wife had seen him in Damages, I think he was in recently, and she said, what about him? You think, well, unless you ask these people, you don't know if they'll do it or not, you know. And he just said yes, you know. It's the same with, you know, Larry Smith, the cinematographer, who's, you know, who's done Eyes Wide Shut, and Nicholas Winding Refn's films. You know, before I worked with them on The Guard, I thought, oh, it'd be great to get somebody like that, but they'd probably never do it. But unless you ask them, you don't know. And, you know, Larry said yes. Michael Emmett, as he calls himself, he was a wonderful presence on set, let's put it that way. I think he travelled around Ireland for a while before he got to the set. Very, very nice man. What did he say to me? He said when he first arrived, I've just met your wife, you have great taste. I wish I could say the same for her. that was the... And I'd mentioned in Bruges, I said, oh, you know, my brother made that film. And he said, yeah, he's the successful one in the family, right? I'm only doing this movie to get to him.
He said to me then, he went up, he dropped me a note, and after we finished in Sligo, he dropped me this note, and he said, I made my way up to Dublin eventually. He said, I mentioned your name in every restaurant, paid full price.
Okay, right over here. Go ahead.
What makes the movie work so magnificently is the rhythm. And the rhythm isn't just the, as you point out, the big scenes with the helicopter versus the small ones, But there's a sequence, oh, a little more than halfway through the movie, where you go from these holy scenes, serious ones, to a comic scene, and right back, and just up and down. And did you have that schematic rhythm in your head before the movie was being shot, or did that sort of just happen as you had certain sequences and you said, well, maybe they're not going to work as well this way, so I'll back in, and you end up backing into that type of sequence? But the bottom line is just magnificent.
Thank you. In the writing of the script, I knew it was episodic, and I knew certain scenes didn't necessarily have to follow one after another. Because, you know, the way the narrative was set up, it's not so plot driven that one scene has to follow another. So I knew I had once I'd come to the post production doing the editing, I knew I had kind of room to breathe. For instance, the scene with Kelly Riley in the confessional in the script. That the scene with Donal followed directly on from that, and I thought, well, it's two really dark, heavy scenes in a row. That then they're sort of similar, you know, they're both kind of confessional. So, I deliberately shifted them around and put a sort of lighter scene, if you take it that way, in between. And what I've discovered, I mean, that's just pure, you know, that's just going by instinct. I wouldn't say there's a big overly intellectual overview of the whole thing. But what discovered then when we started screening the movie was the humour lasted longer than I was expecting into the film. I thought by the halfway point when we have the scene with Donna, it would kind of die out, really. And I think what it is that people want some kind of relief from the heaviness, so they're willing to laugh longer than I actually expected. But I think that was just instinct or chance, really. I had no overriding meaning to do that, other than myself sitting there, you know, in the editing suite going, boy, we've just had three really dark scenes in a row, maybe I should lighten this up a little bit, you know.
did you film in sequence, I mean, just to keep the emotional?
No, yeah, it's all chopping around, you can't really do that on the budget we had. And we only had a 29-day schedule, so, you know, it was it was pretty intense.
They had all the whole beat scene. The whole beach scene at the end was done in the first week.
Yeah, so we had the conclusion. But in a way, that it was a really intense week and really tiring and everything, and sort of emotionally exhausting. But once it was done, you know, we kind of relaxed a bit because we knew we got the end of the movie.
Yeah, we had someone to head towards, and we had a framework in place. Hmm. We knew it was solid. What had happened, you know, you can feel it that it's working. So it was quite reassuring. It was a tough week, though.
I mean, the original schedule was 27 days, and once we got through that first week and got the ending finished, we were given an extra 2 days.
Okay. Anybody? I can't really see hands in the back, but go ahead.
It's a beautiful film, and thank you. I had a question about, in the credits, cutting to the empty locations. It just was a surprising thing. Usually these days you cut away to sell the sequel or something like that.
It kind of comes, it follows on for all those, obviously all the scenes are the scenes where we saw the priest with his daughter. So it's kind of reminded the audience of what's been lost, I suppose. You know, whether his daughter forgives the killer or not, a human being has died and he's gone, and he'll never be there again. It was also, you know, when I got all those shots of Ben Baldwin and it becomes such a brooding presence in the movie, it became this overriding feeling of, you know, Ben Baldwin does not care about our petty concerns. That mountain will be there after we're all gone. And so it was that kind of brooding darkness to the movie that I wanted. Just on a purely pleasurable thing, I always like things happening in an end credit sequence, you know. And I like pre-credit sequences as well, so I'm always trying to do that. I think in The Guard, you know, we go off and we see all the other actors and do that kind of stuff. So I just... You know, I hate movies that go straight into just a long list of credits. I hate films that open up with shots. You know, it's like it's set in Boston, so we get a flight over Boston. It's like, who cares? For God's sake, you know, start the movie, start the bloody movie. I don't want to see Boston, you know. But they do it all the time for some reason. They love all those. That
shit. See, John always arrives at a movie on time.
Well, you sure get right to the point with the opening line in this film, right? Was that always how the film started?
That was the intention, yeah. Don't arrive late for this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Over here.
because it felt like you were trying to make a comic book, you know, this is the reality of what happened, but it's also extremely vivid.
Yeah, speaking about the violence at the end of the movie, I shot it, but you know, both ways, slow motion and normal time or whatever. And it felt, when we cut it in normal time, it felt too quick. It felt like, you know, we've watched this man all through the movie and now he's dead in a split second, which I guess that's what violence is like in real life. But it didn't feel sort of weighty enough. And obviously, once you've made that decision and then you're showing it from four different angles, you know, it is literally overkill, I suppose. I mean, you know, if we want to be realistic about violence, you know, that gun would actually blow that man's head apart, you know. But so I don't go that far, which, you know, some filmmakers may say, well, you should go that far because that's what the reality of violence is. So in a way, it's sort of, even people who think that might be too violent as it is, to me, it's not violent enough, really. But I'm just not interested in making that type of a movie. So it's, you know, I was trying to be realistic up to a point. But yeah, it was, the reason it's there was just because I felt a man's life had been snuffed out and it was gone and it was nothing. So it was just to prolong that moment.
Okay, down here.
Yeah, I think it's a Peruvian band, and it, what's being said in the lyrics is about a character who's going up to the mountains to die because the air is fresh and clean up there. So basically, even the song at the end is about death. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so the whole film's been about death, and so is the final song. Los Chiriguanos, they're called, and the song's called Subo. That came to me very... very late. I found it in a John Voight movie from 1970, directed by Charles Eastman, a very obscure movie, and it was actually at the start of the film, and we were right in the middle of trying, you know, I'd been trying to find a song to end it for ages, and I just saw this in this film. The American Boy, I think it was called. Yeah.
Okay, right down here. Were there any... So just... maybe the church, the Catholic Church had the dog. No, did you have any reactions from the religious perspective that were interesting? And then he wants to know who killed the dog.
No reaction officially from the church or anything like that. The actor, Gary Lydon, who plays the policeman, who's with the gay hustler or whatever, he went to Mass and the priest recognized him and shook his hand and then gave a sermon saying everyone should go to see the movie. That's an individual priest, I guess. I think probably, you know, the priest is a hero, really, so I wouldn't say they'd be too against it. And I guess, you know, Pope Francis and all that now, they're trying to talk it through and communicate about everything that's happened, not brush it away or try to hide like they've been doing for so many years. Let's say a lot of the interviews we've been doing, let's say with Christian-based organizations, have all been pretty intelligent and they take it on board for what it is.
Yeah, we did an Episcopalian priest the other day on a phone interview, and he said it all seemed terribly familiar to him, which was kind of reassuring for us in terms of the confessional nature and the way people would basically dump, you know, their angst and their pain and all the rest of it, and that he found it kind of inspirational.
So yeah, he thought it should be shown at Sunday school.
Yeah.
Or whatever. I thought, maybe a bit too far. the dog... Who killed poor Bruno? After Bruno is killed, there's the next big major scene where all the characters are together. They're in a bar. And one of the characters has a bandage on his hand, implying that the dog bit him when he killed it. But, you know, you'll have to watch the film again to find out.
Okay, we'll run it again after you leave. Okay, up in the middle there.
Some of the comments you made about humanity in general, do you find yourself coming away about humanity or less optimistic?
Yeah, about the same. I don't really sort of believe in catharsis in a way. I think people are the same at the end of a movie as they are at the beginning. I mean, that's just me being negative. I don't know. I mean, a lot of the times you're writing scenes and you watch the film later on and you say, oh, that's what I meant. You know, sometimes, again, maybe this is just me, but, you know, if a scene is good, obviously it will have meanings above and beyond what you intended as well, because it will mean something to other human beings that it might not mean to me. But I definitely wanted to make a film that was unironic, you know, in the sense of the lead character. I'm getting a bit sick and tired of ironic movies. And I did want to end on, however bleak and somber the film is, I did want to end on hope, really. I didn't want to make a negative film.
Yeah, I mean, it was very important. I think art is to make, or allows people to feel less alone. And for me, a lot of what I found myself expressing in that part had to do with a kind of humility and a kind of generosity of spirit that, say, my mother's generation, it would have been more clear-cut in. I had a particularly good Christian brother in primary school, for example. I had an aunt who was a nun in South Africa who was the most cosmopolitan person that I had ever met, warm-hearted, warm-spirited. And there was a kind of a beauty in their faith which... you know, I think needed to, for me, I was delighted to express it with a genuine, with a genuineness. And so that, you know, there was also the idea that when this is gone, you know, and a lot of rejection of the Catholic Church or faith or whatever is happening, that you've got to be careful about what is going to replace that, what belief system is going to happen, where does the humanity or the humanism come into it, where you believe that human beings are worthy of compassion and generosity. And so for me it was a very significant film that way. I did feel cleansed by it in a way, or encouraged at least, that there's a fight out there that's worth fighting.
I mean, to be honest, you know, having made the film, the whole thing about, you know, forgiveness has been highly underrated. In a way, that did influence me. I hold grudges quite badly. You may have sensed that from me, but and I went out drinking with one of the actors. We'd been drinking for a few hours. He'd been drinking sake and bourbon. And he went crazy and he ended up punching me in the neck twice. And, you know, in the old days, maybe before this film, I would have never spoken to him again. But I thought, you know, you've made a film about forgiveness. maybe you should forgive the guy. So I did.
So anybody, if you get into a fight on the way home, remember there's always tomorrow.
Okay, we'll just take one or two more. So anybody else? Or back there.
Yeah, it was in this. That's a good point, because in the script, that was meant to be a scene that early on, when he looks back, there was a cutaway and we see that somebody is watching them, but we don't know who. The scene never really worked. Also, he finds what we don't. It was meant to be that he finds a dead bird that's covered in maggots. So and. It just, the scene never seemed to work. But I loved it has a really cold blue look to it, a very dark blue look. And I kind of liked it, and I thought, I'd like to save the scene in some way. And I just woke up one day and thought, well, you know, if you cut out the pigeon, it becomes a dream. And people can read into it whatever they want to read into it. So I was able to save the scene and come up with some bullshit intellectual rationalization for it. I mean, it could still possibly be cut, but I just felt it goes from him washing his hands in the sink with the bloody knuckles to him waking up, and I felt it gives it just a bit of a moment of, like, what, even if it's just what the hell is that about, and then we cut to him waking up, it's like, yeah, it's a nightmare, it's something he's dwelling on, it's in the back of his mind. It kind of fulfilled a kind of a pause moment, and that's kind of the reason I kept it.
It was also the thing about, you know, the myth of that stone crushing Fiona, you know, there was a terror in it. It felt to me, I always loved that.
That's right. There was more when she speaks about the split rock and it crushing. We actually had scenes of Kelly, you know, there was meant to be a sequence of her inside the rock and all that kind of thing. I thought that was kind of prolonging the nightmare too much, so we just sort of pared it down.
Yeah, but it was very real in terms of his terror, where he could see the whole thing was beginning to crush him and crush everything that he loved. So it's something that, you know, you can be flippant about it and everything else, but for me it was a very real horror he was walking into, and it's, I don't know whether subliminal or whatever, kind of works for me.
Yeah. Okay, just going to take one more. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wonder if in the writing there was ever a point where you considered the priest dealing with the threat in another way than he does in the film.
Well, obviously, we're setting that up with the gun because you don't know what he's going to do with the gun. Yeah. But it was always, I mean, when I sat down, the priest was always going to die and he was never going to defend himself violently. So that I always had that. The only thing, I didn't have who the killer was going to be until I was two-thirds of the way through writing the script. So I only decided.
So he's never going to live.
He's never going to live.
No matter what I said to him.
fight for what, to live?
You fight for the character's life.
No. I funnily enough, we shot that the first week, and I did, for the most part, even after the first shot, feel Chris O'Dowd's pain. Of all of those things that came through to me, that was what was so exhilarating about knowing that that was in the can. I knew that, you know, that one of the things in this movie is that child abuse is a life sentence, and that there was no sense of blame really at all after that shooting. It wasn't blame. Blame wasn't what was appropriate, you know. So that was a kind of a big revelation to have and to have done in the opening week.
Okay. Well, you've created really an extraordinary character and performance, and thank you so much, both of you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.